This will make us the first country in the world to enshrine in law binding climate change targets and stretching and ambitious targets, and they need to be so, 80% by 2050.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, part of an ongoing series of programmes following the politics of climate change and the bright promise of our low carbon future for Resonance FM in London and a number of other community stations around the UK. We've been following the progress of the Climate Change Bill since it was introduced by Michael Meacher into the House of Commons as a symbolic bill back in July 2005. That kick-started what became a massive grassroots campaign by thousands of ordinary people and by an unprecedented coalition of civil society organisations under the banner of the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, with a combined membership of over 4 million people. Just over 3 years later, and a climate change bill is just weeks away from being given royal assent and passing into UK law. This is how Ed Miliband, Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change, announced the bill's third reading in the House of Commons on the 28th of October 2008.
This will make us the first country in the world to enshrine in law binding climate change targets and stretching and ambitious targets, and they need to be so, 80% by 2050. And I think they provide a scale of ambition, Mr. Speaker, which will enable us to play our part with authority in seeking a global agreement at Copenhagen at the end of next year. As Friends of the Earth have said, the world's first climate change law will also be a world-class climate change law. Let me end, Mr. Speaker, though, by paying tribute not to those in this House, but those outside this House. Those who saw the dangers of climate change and the actions that needed to be taken long before the politicians did. The scientists who detected the problem, the campaigners who fought to bring it to public attention, the green movement that mobilised for change, and above all, Mr. Speaker, the members of the public who wrote to us in record numbers asking for a bill which met the scale of the challenge. I believe we have met that challenge. We owe them a debt of gratitude for making it happen, and I urge all members to support this third reading.
The amended bill was passed in the House of Commons almost unanimously by 463 MPs voting in favour and just three voting against. Unfortunately, the bill is still fatally flawed, as it allows the government to meet up to half of the 80% target by buying up carbon credits from other countries. This is presumably why the government thinks it is still possible to build new dirty coal-fired power stations and expand aviation and still meet these targets. On this edition of the 300 to 350 show, we take one last look at the climate change bill with two campaigners, one MP and one researcher, and ask if there is any scope for closing this loophole when the bill goes into the final so-called ping-pong stage on the 17th of November, when the final agreements on wording are made between the House of Lords and the House of Commons. The importance of closing this loophole was highlighted by the Environment Audit Committee earlier this year, when it warned that our, quote, credible voice in international climate change negotiations is in danger of being undermined by policies such as airport expansion plans and an over-reliance on international credits in meeting domestic emission reduction targets. Also, since this bill is the first of its kind and could act as a model for other countries, it is critical we get it right. Friends of the Earth groups in some 17 of the countries in Europe and Japan are now campaigning for similar bills to be introduced. Here's our first guest, Elliot Whittington from Christian Aid, giving his assessment of the progress so far.
The 80% target is now in the bill, but as I understand it, there's still no limit on the amount of buy-ins that the UK government can use to meet this target, so not all this 80% will have to be met at home still. Is that how you read the bill currently?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think we see the fact that the government has recognised the need to set an ambitious target, and actually some of the science says you should probably even look to going stronger, but it's a good starting point. But, I mean, we would also have to say that fundamentally, what the UK needs to be getting its head around is actually taking action within its own economy. So the fact that the bill doesn't provide any signpost to say that this target should apply to the UK's economy rather than that you could buy in credits to meet your objectives to an unlimited extent is a major flaw in the bill.
As I understand it, the Committee on Climate Change has again been given this as something to give advice on. So it could give advice to the government that a lot of this target has to be met by domestic effort. Do you think that's at all likely?
I think they'll certainly recommend a sort of fairly limited approach. Now, of course, there is nothing that compels the government to take the committee's advice, and that's to a certain extent correct. But I think the problem is that actually we're trying to set out a framework bill to set the UK on the path to a low-carbon future. And without something being in the bill to deal with this issue of the balance between domestic effort and international credits, then I think the framework is missing a major plank.
If what the UK is lobbying for in Europe is anything to go by, there's a Guardian piece here from 18th of September where an internal memo was, I think, to MEPs from the government, saying that the government's line in Europe was that the limit on buy-ins should be 50%. So if that's how they're going to treat the case in the UK, then we're not really looking at an 80% reduction in the UK, we're actually looking at a 40% reduction.
Well, exactly. And again, the instant the UK is at the forefront of governments within the EU pushing for this flexibility is another very worrying sign. Certainly, if this is the approach that industrialised countries intend to take towards climate change, not we're going to act and we're going to help developing countries to act, then basically we can wave goodbye to any chance of dealing with climate change. We're not going to achieve stabilised global warming under 2 degrees. It's going to go way over that. It's going to be 3-4 degrees. We're going to see a radically transformed world. This is not a responsible way of dealing with climate change. You do need to commit to taking hard choices at home.
Perhaps you could respond to what the government's line on this is, because they keep repeating the mantra almost that, you know, a ton of carbon emissions reduced in Bangalore is as good as a ton of carbon emissions reduced in the UK. So therefore this approach of allowing this large amount of buying up other people's supposed credits is a good one.
There is a certain amount of theoretical truth in that, but it doesn't reflect the reality of the way the world is. There isn't a particularly good system for the UK financing cuts in other countries. I mean, there is things like the Clean Development Mechanism, but there are a number of problems. And the emission reductions that you see through the Clean Development Mechanism is very controversial as to whether those are actually real reductions. Some of them probably are, but a large number of them aren't. Somewhere between a third to two-thirds, it has been estimated, are fake reductions, if you like. Now, that's the massive loophole in the system. And the other side that doesn't reflect reality is that, frankly, we're going to all have to make cuts, and we're all going to have to look at new ways of doing things. The world is going to have to deliver an 80% cut globally, or at least something of that order. Now, that means that there isn't really room for the UK to say, well, we'll make the cuts in Bangalore, we'll make the cuts elsewhere, and we don't need to act at home. We're going to have to act at home sooner or later, and it's far more to our benefit that we show we're serious about it, that we take the problem seriously, and that we get on with it, rather than delaying, failing to get that kind of advantage in terms of being one of the innovators, being one of the first countries that would deal with it, and developing the skills and the technologies that we could then kind of benefit from having, creating the green jobs at home.
Is there any scope for change as the, I think it's the 17th of November, isn't it, the ping pong, as it's called, happens, which is the very final stage of the bill. Is there any chance of that changing on that day?
There is a possibility. I mean, it's certainly something that is a live debate, and we should remember that it was the Lords that originally introduced the restriction in the bill. So the fact that the government took it out when the bill went through the Commons means that the Lords do have the scope to do that. Obviously, that's something that we're talking to a number of peers about now, and we should just have to wait and see. It may well be that the Lords push for greater action on that.
Are there any other comments you'd like to make on the bill?
I think there are two things that I'd like to say about the bill. One is, this is a groundbreaking piece of legislation. It was groundbreaking when it was introduced because it was the first of its kind. I think there was an element the government almost wanted to sit back on its laurels and say, look at how well we've done with this. But, you know, we kept their feet to the fire, and we've made a huge number of improvements to the bill. And, it's a real testimony to the strength of people power, the strength of campaigning organisations like Friends of the Earth, Christian Aid, World Development Movement, all these organisations that got stuck in and pushed the government to improve this. And we've got a really good bill coming through, and I think that should be recognised, and we should take a step back and go, actually, there is something that is taking a step forward. And one particular thing that the Christian Aid is pleased about is that we've been pushing for the government to introduce greater transparency for companies reporting on their carbon emissions. And that was something which is, at the moment, it's basically purely voluntary, and there's very little qualitative information, there's very little comparability of information. And we've pushed and pushed, and now there's a provision in the bill for the government to make it mandatory for companies to disclose their carbon emissions to an agreed standard, and that should come in by April 2012. And that hopefully is something that should have a real global impact, because obviously the UK is, despite recent developments, a financial centre, and reporting requirements here will have a weight in other countries, and hopefully will be taken on within Europe and the US, and we'll start to see a sort of global transparency as to the responsibility of different companies for their carbon emissions.
That was Elliot Whittington from Christian Aid. And our second campaigner is Martin Williams, who has been leading on the bill for Friends of the Earth. Friends of the Earth have been pushing hard to make sure that emissions from aviation and shipping are covered by the bill.
I mean, one of the first things that I wondered if you could clear up is just how aviation and shipping are dealt with in the bill, because that's not exactly straightforward, is it?
No, it's not, unfortunately. The bill follows basically the advice that came from Thought of Death Turner's committee, in which he sort of recognised that actually it is quite difficult to allocate exactly which of the aviation emissions coming from international aviation should count as UK emissions and which should count from other countries. I mean, that's been a line that we've had a lot from the government, really as an excuse to do nothing over the last 3 or 4 years. What Adair Turner did go on to say was, however, it was absolutely crucial that these emissions were reduced as well, and that they had to be taken account of, and ministers had to understand what they were, so that they could make sure that cuts in any other area of the economy made up for any sort of failure to cut aviation emissions, and that they had to be a part of the 80% overall cut, and if they couldn't make an 80% cut from aviation and shipping themselves, then other places would have to deliver bigger cuts in order to make up for that. What's now happened is the bill has been amended to make it absolutely clear that ministers must take into account what's going on in aviation and shipping sectors and how emissions are growing there when they set the carbon budgets which they're setting under the bill.
So other sectors might be having to make a bigger cut than 80%?
That's quite possible, yes. It's a decision for government. Now, I think many people recognise that aviation and shipping are difficult areas to cut. At Friends of the Earth, we definitely think there is scope to cut them. There are improvements that can be made to the aeroplanes, and more importantly, there's improvements that can be made to the way we travel so that we don't need to use planes. We can get back onto trains and surface transport, and actually just perhaps holiday slightly nearer to home than we do at the minute, and find ways of avoiding business travel as well. But it is going to be difficult to cut them by 80%. However, the climate doesn't make any allowances just because it's a bit tricky to cut these sectors. The climate still reacts to the carbon dioxide that gets put out there. So if we fail to reduce this sector by 80%, then we do have to make deeper cuts elsewhere.
I mean, it's been a tremendous campaign. A lot of people have been involved. They've been emailing their MPs. They've been visiting their MPs. They've been writing letters. And obviously the groups that make up the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition have been very active on lobbying government and ministers. And we're almost there. We're down to the wire. I mean, you've almost already been celebrating that it's a success. I got an email here from Stop Climate Chaos saying, because of your actions over the past year, the government has committed to cutting UK carbon emissions by 80% by 2050 in the climate change bill we won. But actually that 80% isn't all it seems. There's no limit in the bill as it stands on how much the government can buy in terms of international credits to meet those targets. So we might not be making those emissions cuts at home.
That is still possible under the bill at the moment. I mean, I think it's important to recognise, I think the bill has been a huge success, and I think we're right to be celebrated. It's an immense achievement, and it opens up a whole new tool for us to hold our government to account and make sure that they tackle carbon dioxide emissions. But equally, it's daft to think that because we now have the bill, we can give up and we don't need to do climate change anymore. It's all right. It's all covered by the law. We don't have to worry about it. And I think that issue of the extent to which cuts are made at home and the extent to which cuts are made abroad, as well as the whole issue of what the budgets are actually set at and how rigorously the policies come through to make sure that we stay within them and so on, it's all work that we're going to have to carry on doing. I mean, it sounds depressing, but it's not really surprising that we are going to have to hold the government to this. But we do now have a framework to hold them to, which is something we didn't have before. And we do have an expert committee which is going to be offering useful and powerful advice to help us on the way. And we do have a report every year and a progress report and announcements in Parliament to say whether the government's meeting these targets or not. And all of those things are the things which will help.
Are you still pushing to close this loophole at the last stage of the bill?
We're still hoping that there'll be further moves on this. Yeah. The bill's going into the House of Lords now, and there are amendments on the order paper to further tighten up in this area, and we are certainly supporting those moves to do so. Being honest, I don't think the solution from the House of Lords will meet either the concerns of Friends of the Earth or probably many of the people who are listening to this, because it won't be as tight as we want. And that means that as budgets are set and as policies are brought forward, it's going to be up to all of us to make sure that the government is introducing the right policies. To be fair, it isn't that the whole lot can be bought in. There are other international laws governing the extent to which trading can be used, but I don't offer that as a defence, because those international laws would allow them to trade 50% of the effort, and that's utterly unacceptable. Whether it's 50 or 100, I suppose 50 is better than 100, but it is unacceptable to be buying in that quantity of emissions. We have to become a low-carbon economy. The government say this bill is about leadership and showing that we can lead the way, and we don't lead the way by continuing to pollute at home and just simply paying for projects in other countries to make them make the cuts. That's not leadership in any way at all.
There are a couple of other bills going through Parliament at the moment, and I'm wondering if there's evidence of the climate change bill having an effect, you know, feeding through to these other areas of legislation. I mean, the government made two announcements that they said they'd bring in feed-in tariffs, which is something that people have been campaigning for a long time. And they also said that they will be bringing in, finally, again after a lot of pressure and campaigning, a clause in the planning bill which says that climate change must be a consideration. What is actually happening? I understand from reading Friends of the Earth press releases that those announcements from the government might not be all that they seem.
I mean, the honest truth is, once again, those announcements came about because people campaigned for them. They weren't government decisions. They were the government under pressure from people who wanted those changes. I think the problem with the feed-in tariff is that while we're going to have the powers in the bill, we don't yet have any guarantee if and when they will be implemented. And until we've got a guarantee that the government shall introduce these new regulations rather than the government may just do it if they feel like it at some point in the future, then we are going to continue to call for those to be toughened up. On the planning bill as well, yeah, of course we have to consider climate change when we're making planning applications, but there's tough wording to make sure that happens and there's weaker wording, and at the minute we're on the weaker end of the scale.
I mean, hopefully we'll see some changes in policies around coal and aviation. And
I think that's going to be the next big test, really, isn't it?
That was Martin Williams from Friends of the Earth, reminding us that clearly we will have to continue to drag our government along every step of our low-carbon journey. The feed-in tariff referred to in that interview is the policy which has made all the difference in Germany to the widespread uptake of renewable energy technologies by households and small businesses. It guarantees a high price for selling the extra energy that you create when you sell it back to the national grid, making the whole thing much more financially attractive. Our next guest is the Liberal Democrats' Shadow Environment Minister, Steve Webb, who has worked with campaign groups to draft amendments to strengthen the bill during its passage through the Houses of Parliament.
Rather sadly, you might think I did actually sit through the whole debate on the Parliament channel.
Oh, right.
And then promptly got ill for a week, so I don't know if there's any connection between the two events. But in your summing up, you had a couple of things to say about the bill. Do you just want to elaborate on those?
In principle, clearly the climate change bill is a good thing, and it's a better thing for the strengthening that's happened while it's been going through Parliament. But the worry really is, first of all, that history may judge, not that this is a path-breaking great achievement to get 80% cuts, but that actually we were very modest in our ambitions, and in particular the targets for early cuts are still very weak. And given what we know about the importance of early cuts, I think there's still a risk of us being far too self-congratulatory about the whole thing. I also think that we haven't really made any headway on the issue of domestic effort and not simply buying in the carbon credits, and that's something that we'll need a lot of attention to over the coming years.
What's the scope for that being tightened up on November the 17th?
I think in terms of parliamentary procedure, because the government have already given a huge amount of ground on this bill compared with where it was, I'd be very surprised if they faced possible defeat in the House of Lords, I think the feeling will be that they've gone an awfully long way. So I very much doubt there'll be any further changes. But obviously that doesn't change the substance of the issue. And there is a debate going on between government, between those who are just see this whole thing as a market issue and therefore it doesn't matter where you do the carbon saving as long as you do it somewhere, and those who believe this is also a sort of political issue and one of leadership, whereby the UK cannot be a global leader and drag other countries with them if we're not actually doing it in our own backyard, and simply saying, well, we're buying credits from somewhere else is not really an example of national leadership.
So the Lords were obviously backing the 70% domestic effort at one point, but you're saying that there's not sufficient will there to hammer that one home?
One of the frustrations about the way these things happen is that a lot depends on how determined the House of Lords are to defeat the government. And when we get to this point in the year, where there's only a couple of weeks left before the end of the session, essentially the political parties take a view as to which are the issues on which they can defeat the government, which are the bills they're prepared to hold up. And generally, they'll go for the ones where the government's been most obstructive or whether there is most cross-party support. And I think they'll feel probably that the climate change bill, the government's already given a great deal of ground, and they won't necessarily want to cause trouble.
I mean, I noticed that the issue of domestic effort wasn't even debated in the, what was it, a six-hour debate in the House of Commons. Why was that?
You only have a very fixed amount of time to debate a lot of detail of the bill, and I'd asked the government to carve up that time into chunks so that we could make sure every issue got talked about, and they refused to do that. So we basically had a long list of issues and a fixed amount of time, and people wanted to talk a lot about aviation and shipping and some other important issues, and the time for debating domestic effort just simply didn't happen, and that's very frustrating.
I just spoke to Martin Williams of Friends of the Earth, and he suggested that there wasn't enough political support around the idea of having a commitment to a high level of domestic effort to meet these targets. I guess many MPs think that CDM credits are a good thing, well, either that or that they're just happy to have a bill where an 8% target is effectively meaningless.
I think there's several different things going on at the same time here. I mean, first of all, the lobby groups have picked their issues, and they picked, first of all, 80%, not 60, and they picked aviation and shipping, and those were the two that they have hammered away and hammered away at MPs over. And so the difficulty is it takes a long time to get a message through and to get momentum in a campaign, and if the campaigners now say in the final days of the bill, actually there's another thing we want changing and this is absolutely critical, the MPs are going to turn around and say, well, why haven't you mentioned that in the last 18 months? And that's the difficulty, because you don't just need the Lib Dems and the Tories, you need Labour rebels, and I don't think there are the numbers on that front. I don't take quite such a harsh line as you do on saying 80% is meaningless. I mean, it's not meaningless, because what's happening is the Climate Change Commission will have to plan the route to 80% and have to suggest how we would get there and what the right place for domestic effort against buying in credits would be. And they won't necessarily go soft. They won't necessarily say, oh, it doesn't matter. Because Adair Turner has said it's not the case that a ton of carbon saved in Britain is the same as doing it somewhere else. You know, he recognises the importance of domestic effort. So there will be some pressure for a big chunk of it to be done at home. And Ed Miliband, who I've spoken to about the issue, seems, at least in talking about it, to want a British lead on the issue. By the time we've gone through decades, there is no doubt that we and the other countries will have to decarbonise. We can't all be buying in all our credits from overseas, because there just isn't enough global saving available for us all to do it through that mechanism. So I think what will actually happen is, in the short term, there may be buying in of credits, but in the long term, we will just have to decarbonise, and there is no alternative to that.
That was Steve Webb, Shadow Environment Minister for the Liberal Democrats. And for the record, we did contact Tim Yeo of the Conservative Party, but he was too busy. And we tried to speak to Joan Ruddock, the Labour Minister with responsibility for the Climate Change Bill, but she was really poorly. Finally, we spoke to Alice Bowes, an independent researcher who is part of the Tyndall Centre, which provides the government with policy advice around climate change. What did she think of the bill, and what should our priorities for action be now?
One of the things that we think is quite important is the danger of focusing on a long-term target like 2050, when in actual fact it's the emissions that we're releasing now and how they're changing now which is of crucial importance. So for example, if your emissions increased a lot more now, then your target in the future would need to be adjusted, because it's the sort of the cumulative emissions that matter, because carbon dioxide lasts for around 100 years.
Right, so it's the total amount of carbon emissions that we emit over that period.
Yeah, over that period is what's important.
Right, so it's a lot easier basically to start reducing emissions now. That would make it much easier for us to keep within a budget, really.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose one of the issues there is whatever we do, if we want to aim for 2 degrees, it's not going to be easy. But if we act more rapidly now, then it'll make it easier in the future. But when we say act more rapidly now, then the question is, well, how? And here we would argue that the focus needs to be on energy demand, on behavioural change and on energy efficiency, because those are the kind of measures that you can put in place in a relatively short period of time, whereas large-scale energy supplies are going to be a lot longer in the pipeline. Even building a new wind farm and obviously building a new nuclear power station or carbon capture and storage plant, these things have got very long lead times on them.
So changing the energy supply is important, but that's not going to happen straight away.
No, there are obviously sort of smaller things that perhaps could happen on the energy supply side if you look at micro generation. So we're talking here about solar panels on people's roofs, micro wind turbines and so forth, but they're not necessarily going to have a very large impact unless they were very widespread.
So to make early cuts, what do we need to do?
If we couldn't actually buy non-energy saving light bulbs, if we couldn't actually buy fridges that weren't rated AA, if you couldn't purchase a car that wasn't above a certain miles per gallon or below a certain amount of CO2 emissions per kilometre, these would start to have an impact relatively quickly. So we're not necessarily talking about forcing people to do particular things. What you're doing is you're just presenting them with a different choice of refrigerator, for example.
Right, so legislating for low-carbon goods.
Yeah, low-carbon goods and appliances, and being quite radical about it, not sort of tweaking at the edges.
Isn't it also about changing people's habits? Mm-hmm. How do you do that? I mean, surely there's lots of easy wins if you're able to make people much more energy conscious.
Yeah, I think that's a very difficult one. It always sounds like it's easy to change behaviour in the sense that if you're already quite carbon conscious, you can see what it is that you ought to be doing. The other people have different priorities in their lives and they won't necessarily always think in a low carbon way. But I do think that it's about sort of consistent messages. So, you know, if there's an advert on the television, for example, telling you to switch off your lights and change your behaviour in a certain way, and then you're also hearing from government that we're expanding our airports, for example, then that's an inconsistent message because you're thinking, well, you know, an expansion of the airports is going to increase emissions, so what's the point of me switching off my standby? And I think that those messages of communication and also the policies that are in place need to be consistent to help drive behavioural change, because otherwise there'll be apathy.
At one point, there was an allowance in the bill for the Secretary of State to introduce a system of tradable energy quotas, but that's no longer in there, I understand.
Yeah.
The proponents of that system would suggest that that is probably the best way of reducing demand and changing people's behaviour, and the fairest way.
I think that given the challenge that we face is something that's unprecedented in terms of how can we reduce our emissions very significantly. I mean, we've never done it in the past. And so we have to be starting to think about some of these more innovative policies. And if you go down a carbon tax route, then there'll be certain inequities there. It's not to say that the pricing of carbon doesn't have a role to play, because I imagine that because of the challenge that we face, we need to really pull every policy out of the woodwork and select a whole portfolio across the board that's going to tackle this problem. But I do think that carbon quotas are definitely something that seem to have a lot of potential. They also give you an understanding of, you know, if you set the cap, then you know where your emissions are going to be year on year. And it also engages people in a way that they haven't been engaged before, where they're actually taking control of the decision about their carbon. So whereas it might be confusing at the moment as to when you're purchasing an item or you're using your car, for example, you don't quite know how much the energy consumption is or what the carbon emissions is, and you're not necessarily interested because there's no reason to be. Once you know that you can make money out of that, or you can sell carbon credits, or you can buy carbon credits from other people, then you become much more aware of what's going on. So I think that given the challenge we face, I personally think that sort of carbon trading has got a very significant role to play. I think my main message from the research that we've done is that unless there are very radical and stringent policies put in place, and unless we can get global emissions to peak and start to reduce by around 2015, which is just some 7 years away, then really the 2 degree temperature goal is going to be out of reach. So, and this will be devastating if we exceed such levels of temperature increase. We don't know what all the implications will be of that. So all I would say is that we need to start being much more forward thinking and radical about the policies that we put in place to tackle climate change.
That was Alice Bowes of the Tyndall Centre, based at Manchester University, leaving us with a powerful message about the need for realism and radical and urgent action. On Thursday, the 27th of November in London, the Public Interest Research Centre will launch their climate safety report based on the Australian book Climate Code Red. The report argues that in order to stabilise our climate, we need to find a way to go beyond politics as usual, as it is clearly not up to the task. Alice Bowes Tyndall Centre colleague Kevin Anderson will be speaking at the launch, as will be Caroline Lucas, leader of the Green Party, Jeremy Leggett, director of Solar Century, award-winning journalist George Monbiot, and Tim Helveg Larsen of Zero Carbon Britain. For more information, go to climatesafety.org. That's it for this programme. To hear this programme again, visit our full archive of shows at www.climateradio.co.uk. Thanks for listening.